Accession number 9535, Reel 3.
Mr. George Cole reads Reel 3. Could you tell me something more about your duties as a signaller?
When we were at Chapel's Corner, the vision had been relieved, but we were kept in. There was an international trench on the bluff, as they call it, had been took by the Germans, and I remember the 3rd Division was brought back to retake it, and we had one gun switched around or turned around to cover it, and it was on the 2nd of March 1916, and anyway, when it opened out on the morning, I remember I was lying asleep. I'd been up all night, and I was on lines for that particular time, and I got laid down on the floor, and I was sleeping, and all the racket was going on, and I found out after even the captain come in and look at us, because I wasn't dodging, I was off duty, see, and I was sleeping there, and knocking the bloody place down with gunfire, and eventually I remember the Highlanders come back with prisoners, and they took the bluff, and we'd fired that many, all our ammunition had been spent, see, and they had to send for more relays of ammunition. Well, normally it didn't come up during the daylight, say. It always come up at night, but they did that. They sent word back to lines, wagon lines, and there's 4 wagons of ammunition sent away, and from where we were we could see overland to Kroostrad, and they used to come through Kroostrad over the bridge then into Hebrus, and you used to come up past the cloth hall and up to what Carlisle Fire Corner, and then on the little road to where we were. So we knew these wagons was coming, and we stood there watching. It was a sight of a lifetime. You could see them, and then all of a sudden they went into Ypres, so we lost them then, see. And then when they come through Ypres again, up towards, it was a straight, maybe it was about half, 3/4 of a mile, open country. And they come up there full stretch and gallop. And they were stretched out. Instead of they didn't run together, they say. They spaced them out. And anyway, they all got lucky. They got through with ammunition. Then, when they come into the shelter of the houses, I says, we'll give them the horses biscuits and all sorts. You'd think they were the derby winners. And anyway, unload the ammunition. Your horses, water the horses, give them a drink, and then when they're ready, off they went again and watched them. They all got back safe and sound. But that was a sight of a lifetime, see, and got that road there.
They were under fire, were they?
They were under fire.
You mentioned being a linesman. What did that involve?
Well, and then when I was a linesman, you used to get a run out men in lines. And
how would you do that?
Well, the system then, every line had to be what I call okayed every 1/4 of an hour. Even if there's no traffic on the line, you should ring up, okay, ring up, make sure it was intact, see. And as soon as the line was broke, and it isn't, the man from either hand used to go out, see, to repair the line, the instrument, a pair of pliers, and a jackknife, insulation tape. And it's no case of stopping to wait till it cooled off. You had to get out and mend it, see. And you know, it's just some exciting times. Otherwise, all right, like, see. But I remember one time when I was on a visit to the unveiling of the memorial. And as I said, with a tower on the salient. So we're in this caravan, and we were looking at parts where we'd travelled for when the war, while the time of the war was on. And we're coming up that same road from Hebrews through the little gate up to our shrapnel corner. And I didn't know that a clergyman sat behind me, and he heard me talking to Withenshaw, that was one of our old men, describing this, describing that, describing the other. He says, young man, he says, you seem to know this road around here. So our friend Willenshaw, he says, he should, he's been chased out here like a rabbit many times. He says, I says, I says, I've got all our 8 men and 24 lines. And yet to get out of men. In fact, that's what I was doing when I was wounded. I was out repairing telephone lines.
Can you remember any stories of remembering, of repairing the lines while you were at Epes? Can you remember anything that comes to mind?
Yes, I remember one time at Epes, the line run out so zilly back. And I went out, Tandy and me went out, and we're busy on finding a way forward. And Jerry must have gotten his eyes on us. And we're running along, and we're sitting down and repairing this line, and he dropped a shell, reached close to her, and we're both laying that hole. Because they always say, where everybody drops a shell, he never puts us two shells in the same hole. And we went along and skedaddled on the back of that. But all of us from Queer Jobs repairing line.
How did you go about finding the break and then
repairing it? The method there is you went with a line in your hand, because the line's always on the bottom, see?
The bottom of a...
The telephone line is only be about 1/8 inch thick, see? And you used to lay them out on the open country, see? And when he went out to repair line, if it was daylight, you could look down, you could see it, see? If it was dark, you put the line in your hand and it runs out, see? Till he met count of the break, see? When it got broke, say it was dark, if it was dark and broke, you used to walk, one came on the line, the other one walked around a circle, grew up on the ground, they come across another line, I say. Then you tap into that, and if it was the other hand...
How did you tap into it?
You put the two lines on your instrument. Say there's two telephone lines, between the lines. You just put one on the two terminals, the line and the hearth, and you tap in, get back the battery. That was okay, see. Then... You find all the two lines, see? Find out them. Oh, that was all pip. That was all pip. Then join them up together, see? Then when they join, give another ring through to make sure it was okay, see?
Was it always possible to find where the line had gone if a large shell had landed in the area?
You couldn't find out where it had gone unless you went out to it.
No, I mean, when you found the break and you got one end, was it sometimes difficult to find the other end?
That's what I say. You still get the twin wires. You get them two lines, put them on, and you ring back, set the battery. You knew the battery was behind you, because that section of line from the battery to where you were was intact. Then you used to grow up round and find the other two ends belonging the forward part, see? When I used to grow up round, you didn't know whether you hope it lines or not. Once you put them on the instrument and call somebody up, see? You might get another battery or another whole pip, see? But you used to put them two lines on, start buzzing, and give your call sign. They speaking. Just give your call sign, see? If you were getting the correct call sign, that man would answer your back, see? You always tell not to speak. Always use the call sign, see?
What about the signaller's duties at the battery? So you've done the observation post and the lines. What would you do when you were on battery duty?
Well, the battery duty, you used to work a kind of rotor. There was half a man on duty, 24 hours at the battery, say. Now, we had lines to telephone, to the forward, maybe to another battery, to headquarters, such as that. There's 5 or 6 lines, I would say. And this matter, when they went down, had to be out and repair them, say. And
so the linesmen were based at the battery, were they? They went out from the battery looking for faults.
That's what I'm saying. All the signals, the old battery signals, used to work in some kind of a rotor. Forward, battery, linesman, or though you kept, you couldn't keep it up regularly, you know, because it's always something upset at sea.
So the battery person would just stay at their post?
He'd stay at their post.
They wouldn't go out.
There was three, generally three men, worked 24 hours for the 3 hours, say, and if it came to a push, that man was off duty, he had to get out and do something, see, yeah. And you had a line to the, Jenny had a line to the officers to come now, saying, I remember one time when we were at Harris, I was on night duty. Quiet, you see, walk here the lines, every quarter of an hour, you know, ring up, walk here, walk here. Maybe never speak, just call him up, give his call sign, headquarters, or wherever you are, give his call sign. He would answer then, you would say, walk here, walk here, that was it, say. Now that had to be done every quarter of an hour. Anyway, this particular night at Harris, at one court, I was on, and headquarters rung up, walk in, and we had a code name for the battery. At one time it was Tyne, Mint, Seasley, or Parsley, say. Another time it would be Cow, Pig, Dog, or Rabbit. And you had to speak like that. This is cow speaking, see? And you sounded in different positions, see? I didn't know what it was for, like, but anyway, headquarters rung us up this night, and on the line, he said, I've got something important for you. I said, all right. He says, just hang on. Oh, no. So he's rung all the buttons, rung all the everybody. Different ones, rung them up. Are you all there? Here, buddy? Time, mint, pinch, salt, parsley, so and so. Right. Now listen carefully. Listen, I thought it was some news about the war. The war hadn't finished. And all of a sudden, we heard the music. And it was the tune, it was also what they would call the top of the pops now, Yakahola Hickey Doola. And somebody belonging to headquarters had fetched a gramophone back. And they were playing his record on. And all the buttons on was listening. It was quiet, there was nothing of stealing. And I think that'd been one of the first Oak Hoops ever. Yakahola Hickey Doola. And after it was played, they were all bust out laughing. And I asked him, and he put one or two more records on. And that was at one court in 1917.
When you were at the forward observation post, what did you think of the front lines? What impressions did you get of what life was like in the front lines and conditions there? What could you see of it?
Primitive, you know, the no dugouts, soldiers lying in at night, at the time, they were just lying about there. So. And worse still, when the rain came. That was the terrible part of the year when the rain came, I say. And the infantry was worse enough, but we were bad enough. But ours was only for, say, 24 hours or...
That's how long you'd be at the post, was it?
Sometimes we have 24 hours, sometimes 48 hours. It depends on the condition.
How were the forward observation posts disguised? Did they have any special methods of disguise at that time?
No, you're just to pick a place where you could see and not be seen. That was the idea, like, see? Because if you got a place, there's a point, you got as high as possible, see? To look down, you know. And it's obvious from the German side, they used to know that them places that was high up was the lightest place for observation if it was being. Because they're as wise as what we were, you know, see?
Did they bombard you a lot? You told me about the time when they collapsed.
Oh, yes. But you see, what used to happen, when we used to go into the area, when I first went in, used to spy the land out, and they saw anybody, any movement out, used to mark them down, or different parts of the A target, B target, register them. Now, the gun used to know that if it said A target, it was so and so arranged, so and so angle of sight, and so on, I say. And they had them charted up in the gun pit. And if you saw any action anywhere there, you could get spot on in a tick there. I remember one time, Mr. Richardson, he was killed the morning I was took prisoner. We used to call him Whiz Bang for nickname. He was a lovely little fella. But that was his nickname. I didn't know whether he knew it or not. He was a fine little chap. And anyway, we were up at Harris, and I was as keen as anybody watching, looking out North Sea, and I had good eyesight now, very seldom I used glasses. Anyway, I could just say something like somebody using a shovel, shoveling some muck up, you know, see. So I tell Mr. Richardson, say, he says, where was that course? So I directed him to it, say, yes, yes, yes. So he got his trench map out and I looked at it. He says, well, stop me digging and we'll put one to each other. I said, yesterday, Jerry did it with us, say. And I remember one time, it was at one court, and the communication sense, because it goes so far, then getting the communication sense, Egret, they call it Egret. And this particular day, during the night or something, he'd had a direct hit on the trench, say. Why it meant anybody going through had to get over this ape of muck. Jerry must have spotted them and got a machine going on. So we were going forward, and it was a French officer. He used to send officers from the ammunition column, and he used to take them off a bit. Tuition, you know, I'd say. And we were going forward, and he was on front. And these chaps came down the stairs. I said, are you going right up forward? I said, no, I said, we're only going up Egret Loop. I said, it's the old pip, see. He says, well, be careful, he says, he's had a direct hit on the trench, so he says, he has a machine gun on, be careful. Right over there, see. So when I come to this spot, this officer, forget what his name was. He says, this will be the spot. I says, yes, sir. I says, jump straight across. Never hesitate, say. So he jumped over the way across, and I just stuck at the back. And initially jumped up, about 3 or 4 rounds. You know. He stopped dead. He was all right, saying this. Are you all right? I said, oh, they fear me being all right. I said. And I hadn't followed him, say. He says, oh, he said, oh, no, I said, you're too old. I said, you learn all these tricks, sir, when you come on, say. I said, he couldn't catch here. See, he couldn't hit one man. But he's assuming there's somebody following him, he'd catch them, see. So I says, whenever you like that, I says, never follow house, leave a gap, see. And anyway, I hunted the boat and got a piece of board, stuck it in the trenches, so either side, one and anybody else coming, like. And it was repaired during the night, they built up. And we were at Johnny Beck, Bashneel Job. My mate and me were going forward, and there were rations in the sandbags. That was a carry hold off everything, sandbag. And when everything in the sandbags, and I was carrying a petrol can full of drinking water, see. And there was a party coming down. And on the dump boards, there's no passing, you had to walk on these dump boards, so. And he says, can you spare me a drink of water, Gunnar? I said, yes, sir. I said, but I says, there's nothing to drink out of mine. I says, all those stuff's packed away in the sandbag, see? Oh, I said, to him, so soon screwed the top off, and he drunk out the 2 gallon petrol. I thought many times, if I'd had a camera, it would have been a wonderful photo. The party standing drinking petrol, water with a petrol can.
Talking about that, what were your rations and water supplies like when you were at the battery? I'm thinking about earlier in the war, really, when you were at Shrapnel Corner.
Oh, yeah. Shrapnel Corner, each battery had a water, what was the car? No, the water cart. Like a tank on. And, I would say, maybe about 50 or 60 gallon in, see? And it used to come up each night to the position. And he used to fill everything with it, see. But it got the finish, the storm was the start of it. There had thousands and thousands of 2 gallon petrol tanks. And they were loaded up back by. And that was part of your daily ration, infantry and all. That was your only means of drinking water, say that. What could be petrol cans?
What was the water like?
Oh, it was all right.
Didn't taste of petrol.
Oh, no, why? I think we sell that the petrol cans would be brought new, made especially for the petrol cans, but there was a section of new ones kept especially for petrol, see? They must have known to, because there was thousands of them used. In fact, there were saddles, the artillery had certain saddles made, and you could put, I believe it was either five, I believe it was five on either side of the horse, the petrol cans. Proper saddle for the you want to see. And they used to come up every night because it was a crime to drink shallow water, see.
Well, did you have enough water then?
Oh, yes, we had plenty of water, see.
What was your food like at Sanctuary Shrapnel Corner?
Why, it was just a normal. Only so well, there wasn't enough of it.
Can you remember what it was, though? What you'd eat?
You also get, you know, fairly rarely, you got a little bit of bacon on the morning, a little bit of bacon, see? And then the main meal was always stew, see, and they placed my roast and stew.
You get a proper hot stew, though?
Oh, hot stew, yes, aye. And there, the infantry had some big Dixies, and they used to call them a ration up there, the stew, you know. But then sometimes it got that bad you couldn't get nothing at all. Bully and biscuits.
How long were you at Shrapnel Corner?
Well, as near as I could see, we were there 2nd of March. We went in before the Christmas. And the attack on the Bluff was the 2nd of March. 1916.
And that's when you came out.
And then shortly after that we came out.
Had you been in much action during that time? Had there been much?
Oh, but it was the station, and then it got a different position. We were in that position practically all the time, see? That one position, see?
Were you shelled a lot?
Oh, he used to stop the place, you know. So in fact, one night, the signalers was lying in the dugout. It was about 78 line, where they had to begin a big sandbar of wall. And during the night, there was a shell dropped outside. And I remember, a shell dropped outside, shook the life out of her, and there was stuff round on the sandbar. And anyway, we had a funny comic, it didn't matter what happened, he was every joke, Tommy Meekins. Get your British selves to sleep. He said, it's all right, we're all right. So later I went to sleep again. And just for curiosity, the next morning, I went out and had a look. When you know this shell had dropped close to you, and it had ripped the whole ends of the sandbags off. And there was only the sandbag wall. If it had another 2 yards of range on, we'd all have been gone. And the hedge of the shell crater, our wall, protecting our ways, was on the edge of the shell crater. So,
did you suffer many casualties during that time at Shrapnel Corner?
Well, we didn't have a lot of shrapnels. Mainly, the signals used to get most because they were holding the open.
So the battery never actually got caught?
The well counter never got caught. Because if a battery got caught, that was domino, see? Once he got onto the battery, same with German battery, once you got onto a battery, they used to wipe them out, see? They get the heavies on there. Failed guns couldn't wipe another failed body out. So they wanted heavy enough shell. Well, it caused some damage. But the one for shifting, the jellies used to get the 5-9 bodies out of the nearly 16 shells, I say.
So they never actually got the range of exactly where you were, so they couldn't put the heavy
batteries. They knew you were somewhere in the boat, likely. But
they never found exactly
never
where.
Never found out, say. If you were in the battery, you weren't allowed to make a proper track. You also get on different roads because laying across the grass would make a path. Eh?
Did you ever work with aircraft, or did you ever have to take any precautions about aircraft?
We never had no working with them, but when we were at one court, we had a forward gun and come up. Mr. Batch, he was on about that when he was on about the raid, say.
We'll come to that then, and that sounds like it's part of that.
I was going to say, though, Our gun position, the forward gun position at Gamap, the Air Force took photographs of it to make sure it was unobserved. They knew where it was, eh?
To make sure it wasn't. What did you use for camouflage when you did do camouflage?
All the camouflage, I think it's branches and all sorts. At Tarmontius, outlines were there. We had the dummy gun, dummy battery. And on our right, maybe about 50, 60 yards on our right, we had some old French carts, got the wheels off them, and we had a dummy trunk, dummy barrels on, and we camouflaged them so they could see them, see? You know what I mean? And they were camouflaged, so they were spotted. And you could just see the muzzle sticking out, you know, see? But whenever we did any firing, I bet your life that the dummy tanks, the dummy guns got the hammering.
So you left in March 1916. Where did you go from there?
From there. That's when I say we went to Kemmel, joined the second line, and went to Kemmel, see? And the original battery hours in there, I don't know where they went to after I left them. I went to the C-25.
So you left 252?
252, I left them. They said I went to 253. See.
And that, which battery?
And I never got close to the battery, original battery again till I saw them. And we relieved them at Fleurs one time.
This is 252.
252, we're leaving them. Because we walked up, we left the gun, the system on the SOM was, when the battery was being relieved, instead of fetching the guns in and taking the other one out, see, yeah, you used to hand the guns over. So one set of guns was doing all the firing, and the other set of guns was just being weighing the boats, see. And when it went into Fleurs, that was before the Christmas 1916. We walked up, and this sergeant was on the Nova, and number one going so and so, and the different dugouts, and he had a torch. And I says, "That's Sergeant Dawson." I recognised his voice. He says, "Yes, it's Sergeant Dawson. Who's that?" And he put his torch. He says, "Good God, Corey, he's still here." I says, "All right." So I says, "What's this place here, Sergeant?" He says, "This is Fleurs, call this Fleurs." I says, "Fleurs?" He says, "Where do you think it was?" I said, "I'll tell you what I thought." I said, "I thought the book was Killarney, where all the lakes, all the shallows, and when it's very late, it went up in the trenches, it lit the reflection." I said, "I thought it was Killarney." And as it happened, he was, their battery was going out, and he was going out with all of them, but with the section that I was in, there was some the section that come to make a six go and say, there was some of his old friends, and he stopped down eight to have the night with them, and he was killed the next morning. If he'd gone down in his normal way, but that was his fear, he had to be killed, say.
So you went to C battery in 253. Did you mind leaving 252 battery? Were you disappointed?
No, because the best battalion I went to join was the ones I joined up with at the army, the same army, see?
When you joined the army originally?
When I joined the army originally, there was a lot on the ball column was the same fella, see?